Dr. Al Kasniak is a professor of psychology, neurology, and psychiatry at the University of Arizona. His research specialties include memory, emotion, and aging. He also served as director of the U of A's Center for Consciousness Studies. Recently, Dr. Kasniak studied how long-term Buddhist meditation, including silent meditation, affects both the brain and human consciousness. Dr. Kasniak, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Let's start by having you give us just a little of your background.
Yeah, so I am a neuropsychologist by education and training. You know, that means I've had a longstanding interest in the relationship between brain and mind. And fairly early on, as an undergraduate, I became interested in contemplative traditions and practices. And during the period of time of my graduate study, I tentatively explored some of that with what was then a relevant available technology having to do with electroencephalographic biofeedback. In retrospect, that turned out to be a blind alley, I think most of us would agree. But it provided a way for me to look at, in a laboratory context, some of the kinds of things that were being brought up in some very early studies, EEG studies, of long-term meditation practitioners. Having completed that work, which was my master's thesis, it began to be apparent, this was the very early first part of the 70s, that there was a kind of societal and also university scholarly pushback against some of that, much of it being identified with hippies and cultural revolution. And to cut to the chase, it became clear that this was not a good time for an aspiring junior faculty member to place all of his eggs in that particular basket. So I developed another area of my interest, which had to do with aging in the brain and age-related neurodegenerative disorders. And that really became my, what you might call bread and butter research. That's where most of my NIH funding has come from. That's what I'm probably best known for academically. But I continued my interest in a personal way with contemplative practice, and in particular with Zen Buddhism, and spent many years as a Zen practitioner, going to numerous retreats, including silent retreats that are, I take it, the interest in the story you're doing.
Yes.
And have worked with a teacher, Joan Halifax Roshi, who is the abbot at Upaya Zen Center, and not too long ago received what's called Dharma transmission from her, which makes me an independent teacher or sensei within the Soto Zen lineage. So that's the contemplative practice side of it. Then about 10 years ago, it became apparent to me that there was enough shift culturally and academically that the time was perhaps ripe to again begin to look seriously at the neuroscience and psychophysiology of contemplative practice. And so in collaboration with some of my students, launched a series of studies, primarily of long-term Zen and Vipassana meditators, which we have published and are continuing to write. And I've done some other work in which we're utilizing what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction, a very abbreviated and non-sectarian kind of form of teaching meditation and other related practices. And we've been examining the effects of that, both psychological and biological, in caregivers of people who have neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's disease. So that's been the research side.
Now, you, of course, started the academic side of this. Did your interest on the spiritual side come later through your work for this?
They really were parallel. I kept the spiritual interests more in the closet during those, you know, the years as a junior academic, and also, you know, my pursuit of that really was not able to be quite as vigorous as it was once my two children became adults, and you know, you gain a little bit more discretionary control over your time outside the work setting. And so it gave me opportunities to, you know, both increase the amount of my meditation practice on a day-to-day basis and also do more retreat time.
What's the longest silent retreat you've personally engaged in?
Longest one personally has been 8 days. Within the Soto Zen tradition, that tends to be the length of silent retreats, unlike what is a little bit more true for Tibetan Buddhism and to some extent for Theravada. Zen tends not to lean toward the very long, like 3-month kind of retreats.
Or in this case, in the case of Diamond Mountain here, 3 years. Now, of course, I have spoken to a few people at Diamond Mountain who have participated in retreats. The director out there has been on a retreat as long as 30 days. And I kind of asked him, you know, what happened during that period for him internally. And he did admit that in many cases, some negative things kind of come up. And in a way, taking the distraction of verbalized communication away allows some of that stuff to come up so you can deal with it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's the case. You know, it's enormously variable for people. It really depends upon, you know, what other experiences you've had in your life, your background, the amount of meditation practice you're doing on a regular basis. I'm sure all kinds of personality factors. But it's the case that people are quite variable in their response to silent retreats. For some, it becomes, you know, a source of joy and ease. For many others, especially early on in their practice history, it can be literally excruciating, both in terms of physical pain from the postures, the sitting postures adopted for practice, as well as psychologically painful with, you know, a sense of, you know, really being quite out of control and not being able to at all effectively calm the mind. But I think it's also the case that, you know, with working with skilled teachers, you know, I have, you know, in numerous retreats now over the years, seen very, very few instances where, you know, someone is having sufficient difficulty that they actually have to exit from the retreat. For the most part, the teachers are, you know, quite able to help the individual find a way to move through that and have it end up being a positive experience.
We're talking with Dr. Al Kasniak, a professor of psychology, neurology, and psychiatry at the University of Arizona. He's done specific research into what long-term Buddhist meditation, like silent meditation, does to the brain and human consciousness. Dr. Kasniak, there's lots of stories of people who spend an extended amount of time in solitude and silence, and when they come out of that period, they can't just reintegrate into the busy, verbal, connected world right away. They kind of have to do it gradually. Is there any scientific evidence that points to what's actually happening in the brain as a person comes out of a retreat and tries to reintegrate?
Yeah, so there actually is not really any scientific research on that transition. There's an increasing amount of research on, you know, what happens prior to and after participation in, say, a 3-month retreat. There's something called the Shamatha Project that collected an enormous amount of data and has been publishing this just the last couple of years on the results of that. But the examination of this important aspect of the transition between being in retreat and re-entering into, you know, active society, really is quite understudied. There's a lot of commentary that is made by teachers about it, and I think everyone recognizes this to be a very sensitive period of time. My own experience is that, particularly in those retreats where, I have had more, I don't want to say dramatic because that's not exactly the right word, but more impactful kinds of experiences on the cushion. I've certainly felt myself to be quite raw emotionally, as if, you know, one's emotional responses were really right there at the surface. And some of that, it can be a very positive kind of experience because, my wife tells me it's not a bad deal in regard to our relationship because, you know, there's a sense of openness and compassion. And, I've had that experience with other people as well, feeling that I'm more resonant to them. But depending upon the kind of environment one is returning to, it could also be a period of vulnerability.
I'm reminded somewhat of the parallels between these retreats of silence and the mythical hero's journey. And the whole notion of earlier civilizations would sort of initiate the young in wildland experiences and where there would be some sort of trial and tribulation. And it almost seems as if a vow of silence is in a similar vein. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, Joseph Campbell, while he was alive, wrote quite a bit about this. And, you know, he had a book called The Hero's Journey. And, I think there's a way in which various mythologies kind of play out. Some of what seems to go on psychologically in someone's internal journey in a silent retreat. But again, I guess I would underscore the enormous variability between people. It provides, maybe a general kind of description, but it's certainly, those mythologies, certainly not a template for everyone's experience.
Now, to be sure, an extended silent retreat is certainly not for everybody.
Exactly. And I think, it's one of the things that, really responsible retreat centers are very aware of now and do, some degree at least, of screening of people who apply to be participants and also, engage in due diligence in making sure that, there's a great deal of available teacher attention so that the potential negatives are, really on everybody's radar screen. There's the beginnings of some empirical research on this as well. One of our former students at the University of Arizona and now a faculty member at Brown University and someone who's very involved with things with the Mind and Life Institute here in Boulder, her name is Willoughby Britton. And this is an area that she has very specifically been studying and doing research on over the past couple of years. What are the range of negative experiences? How do we understand them? Who is more likely to develop them? What are the factors in terms of different practice styles or different teacher characteristics that either increase or decrease the probability of these things occurring?
And Dr. Kasniak, you say there is scientific evidence that a silent meditation actually has a profound effect on the brain and human consciousness.
In the research that has gone on having to do with what happens, what changes, if anything, following participation in a retreat, whether it's, fairly time-limited or more protracted. I think the things that are emerging from that fairly consistently are that, there are increases in degree of attention, accuracy, and regulation. And there are changes in the direction of increased emotion regulation. So I think, what we're seeing is the science in all of this tending to support some of the claims that are made by contemplative traditions about attention and emotion regulation or equanimity really being some of the consequences of this kind of practice.
You mentioned at the beginning of our interview that you did some research into this area back in the 70s, and it seemed the scientific community wasn't quite ready for it. They kind of equated it with the counterculture. But now you say that 30, 40 years later, your research from that era has been validated.
Yeah. And, you know, I think where we moved is away from, a notion that was, somewhat pervasive throughout the society, that this was that these practices led to something analogous to psychedelic drug experiences, for example. I think, you know, most everyone involved seriously in this area would agree that that's not the case, that those are not good analogs for meditative experience or the consequences of meditative practice. But real and concrete changes in attentional and emotional stability, I think, are the kinds of things that have been supported.
That's Dr. Al Kasniak, a professor of psychology, neurology, and psychiatry at the University of Arizona. Dr. Kasniak has studied how long-term Buddhist meditation, including silent meditation, affects the brain and human consciousness.